What's up, sports fans? What's up, gamers? Welcome back to the Two Line Offside podcast, the podcast where it doesn't matter if you're onside or offside, just so long as you're inside the lines. So in case it wasn't glaringly obvious by the title of this podcast, today we're going to be talking about the Paralympics and their ever-important classification system, which groups athletes with similar disabilities together, so that it's more likely that athletes are competitive, not because of differences in their disabilities, but because of differences in their skills at their chosen sports. However, the classification system can be super confusing for those who are not in the know. And honestly, it can be super confusing even for people like me who are totally giant sports nerds and in the know about these things. And they can be even more confusing to someone who's just being introduced to the Paralympics for the first time, or honestly, somebody who listens to it watches it every 4 years and then totally forgets how it works 4 years later. So rather than having you sit there watching the Paralympics being, rightfully so, super amazed, but also greatly confused by the classification system, I've decided to create this podcast to give you a leg up. Yes, that was a pun. And yes, I intended it to be a pun on your competition so that you know what's going on next time you watch the Paralympics. Before I do that, though, let's talk about what the Paralympics are and how they came to be. Unlike their Olympic counterpart, the Paralympics do not have roots in ancient Athens, Greece. Although the IPC's website will tell you that the concept of sports for those with impairments has existed since the late 1880s in the form of sports for deaf athletes in Germany. Big ups to early Germany for that! The idea for widespread participation for those with disabilities, though, didn't take hold until after World War II. With so many men coming back from the war that we call the Great War, with spinal cord injuries and amputations, it was at the request of British doctor Dr. Ludwig Guttmann that he began using sports and competitive sport as a means of helping the soldiers in his care recover some function, confidence, and that all-important morale that they may or may not have lost as a result of their injuries. Just in case you're wondering, Dr. Ludwig Guttmann was a British guy. The idea of using sports for rehabilitation was pretty unusual for a few reasons. Disabilities aside, the culture at the time pretty much viewed sports and games as things for either children or boys, or for those lower-class farmers who took the low-paying jobs in what passed for professional sports at the time. The idea of using sport for rehabilitation and confidence was pretty radical. Then, there's of course the fact that it was widely assumed that once you lost your ability to walk, you were not only expected to do very little in society at the time, but you were also definitely not going to engage in sports. Nonetheless, Dr. Guttmann and his patients engaged in what they called the Stoke Mandeville Games on July 29th, 1948, with 16 athletes from the hospital, both men and women, who competed in archery. Later, they would have some international athletes join them from other hospitals, and so it was renamed the International Stoke Mandeville Games in 1952. Finally, as the movement grew to include more athletes and more sports, the International Stoke Mandeville Games were renamed again to the Paralympic Games. So called because they wanted to exist parallel to their already established Olympic Games, and not because the athletes in these games were at first almost exclusively in wheelchairs or paraplegics. The first modern Paralympic Games, as we know them, took place in Rome, Italy in 1960, and featured 400 athletes from 23 countries. And yes, it is indeed true that during the early days, almost all of those competing at the Paralympics were in fact in wheelchairs. Although, much like the games themselves, that would grow and evolve to include those with many more disabilities with time. One more really important thing I wanted to teach you before we get to the really cool stuff. The Paralympics are 100% not the Special Olympics. The Special Olympics is a fantastic organization that traditionally allows those with primarily intellectual disabilities to participate in sport in a supportive, fun environment meant to promote physical activity, fun, and friendship. The Special Olympics isn't something that you typically need to qualify for. They're open to any athlete with intellectual impairment who registers with their local chapter and wishes to compete. I'm certainly not saying that there's anything wrong with the Special Olympics. My only point is that the difference between the Paralympics is that to qualify for those, you have to be a high-level athlete who often has to win or place very high in world championships or para-pan regional events in your chosen sport in order to even make it to the Paralympics. The men and women who compete in these sports are the best disabled athletes in the world, and just like their counter and Olympians, they train for years. They truly are elite athletes. Now, this disclaimer is going to be a little different than most of the ones that I fire off. In the interest of being the most efficient for this podcast, I'm not going to swear at all, though I totally would have beeped them if I did anyway. This disclaimer is more to address the grossness of the internet as a whole. Now, I'd like to presume that 99% of the regular offsiders listening to this podcast are pretty tolerant people. This disclaimer isn't for you. It's for the 0.5% of people who might find this podcast and decide that my podcast's comments section is the place to sound off about Paralympic sport. Now, if I haven't already made it clear in the intro, I'm going to do this podcast in honor of the Olympic Games. As a disabled or para-athlete myself, but not a Paralympian, I'm stoked to finally talk about some of the sports that I love the most. That said, as I write this, we're on day 5 of the Paralympic Games. I've been watching a lot of Paralympic content these last 5 days, and one of the things that seems pretty consistent on Paralympic posts on the internet is a pretty consistent stream of able-bodied folks either making fun of those high-class disabled athletes or claiming that because they're able-bodied, they would absolutely crush these athletes in competition. One, that's super offensive for reasons I hope I don't have to explain, and two, that negates the fact that these athletes are the best in the world at their sport. And three, when push comes to shove and an able-bodied person tries their hand at one of our games, they often soon find that parasport is just as challenging as any other sport to learn for the first time, especially when you consider that something even as simple as pushing a wheelchair, even in one's everyday, involves strength and muscles most able-bodied people don't use nearly as much. You guys haven't seen my forearms, but they're slightly Hulk-like. Lastly, I'm going to be using the terms disabled athlete and athlete with a disability interchangeably in this podcast. Though I respect that there are lots of folks with disabilities who prefer person-first language, I personally don't mind being called a disabled person, because I know in my case, I can't really avoid others seeing my disability at first anyways, because it's so visual. Because of this, it's the language I use the most, and it's most likely to come natural to me. And I hope those of you who prefer person-first language can understand and still enjoy what I think is a really good and informative podcast. All right, with all that serious stuff out of the way, let's get to the point of today's episode, shall we? One of the things that makes the Paralympics different from its Olympic counterpart is the classification system. The classification system is the thing that the Paralympics use to put athletes into categories, both by disability and severity of disability, so that when two athletes are competing with one another, their level of impairment is as closely matched as possible. This ensures that when one athlete beats another, it's happened because of their level of athleticism and not because of differences in how their disability affects them. Turns out, though, the classification system can be pretty confusing. And if you're not in it, and sometimes even if you are, the classification system can be a barrier to folks enjoying the games. Heck, I've studied this in school to an extent, and even I have to relearn this every 4 years. So I figured, in the interest of making offsiders experts for the second half of the Paralympics, I'd do what I could to give all of us a crash course on the class system. and maybe even some of the rules of these unique sports. Want to become an expert with me? Let's do it then. Let's go offside. Again, in the interest of being most efficient so that I can maximize the stuff we can learn together, I'm going to start with the sports that are the least like their Olympic counters and go from there. If you're wondering why I'm already talking about sports and not classes, that's partly because classes start with the sport. In order to keep things the most fair in elite competitions, only athletes with specific disabilities are allowed to play specific sports. Are you an able-bodied person who'd like to try out playing for your local wheelchair basketball team? That's awesome! In the biz, we call that reverse integration, when an able-bodied person joins their teammates in a wheelchair or other equipment so they can play with their disabled friends. Both in the interest of awareness and just in the interest of having enough players to field a team, local grassroots team will often encourage this. There's sometimes restrictions on how many able-bodied athletes can be on a court at any given time, but they'll still most likely be super happy to have you play with them. This is the Paralympics, though, so every athlete has to have undergone disability classification done by a team of doctors. Though even that has its flaws. Got it? Alright, let's jump in then. So the first sport I'm going to teach you about today is boccia. Boccia is one of only two Paralympic Summer Games that doesn't have an Olympic equivalent, but we'll get to more on that later. First things first, the answer is no. I have no idea how to say this exactly. I most often called it bocce, as in botch-e. I've also totally heard people call it bocca, as in broccoli. I have no idea if that's a regional thing or what, but I say it the first way, so that's what we're going with. On to the rules and classification. So the closest sport or game that I could think to use to explain bocce is maybe lawn bowling. Don't let that comparison fool you, though. This isn't your cousin's barbecue party game. At the Paralympic level, this is actually a pretty intense sport to watch, and mad impressive. Let me explain. So boccia first became a Paralympic sport in 1984 at the Summer Games in New York. Here's the basics and the rules. Each player will propel 6 leather balls, either with their own hands or with the aid of a device, but we'll put a pin in that for now. Players play with 6 balls per end, over a total of 4 ends for individual matches. Pair matches and team matches consist of 6 ends. The goal is to have one's balls as close to the white one thrown at the beginning of the end, known as the jack. Who throws the jack is determined by a coin toss. The player or team scores a point for each of the balls which is closer to the jack than that of their opponents. The one with the most points at the end of either 4 or 6 rounds is the winner. Now let's look at the classification and who plays this, shall we? Firstly, bocce is only open to athletes with disabilities in coordination and movement. There are 3 categories of athletes who compete in this sport. There are athletes with cerebral palsy, one of the most common disabilities on the planet, who can throw independently, athletes with non-cerebral palsy disabilities, like amputation of arms or legs, etc., and the last category, which includes any athletes who may require the assistance of ramps or pushers to push their balls onto the field of play. Bocce is one of the few sports in the Paralympics, and the Olympics for that matter, where athletes can play with or against mixed genders of athletes, either in teams or as individuals. That said, let's get specific with these fancy classification letters and numbers. Like I said, bocce is reserved for those with fairly severe motor and coordination disabilities like cerebral palsy, or others, which may impair a person's ability to either pick up and or throw that leather ball with ease. From a classification standpoint, that means that athletes in bocce are split into one of 4 categories. In bocce, as in all of these sports we'll talk about, the first letter is pretty easy. It speaks to the name of the sport. So everybody who plays bocce has their classification start with BC, which literally just stands for bocce. Here's the specific classifications. BC1. According to the Canadian Paralympic Committee, BC1 is, quote, for both CP1 and CP2 throwers, where CP1 refers to a thrower with cerebral palsy who throws the ball independently with their hand, And CB2 is a person with cerebral palsy who chooses to throw with their foot. Yeah, you heard that right. Some athletes choose to use their feet over their less coordinated hands. How impressive is that? For BC1 athletes, an aid can only help the player adjust their chair at the direction of the player. Please don't touch another person's wheelchair. And giving the player their ball at the request. BC2 athletes are slightly more able than BC1s. They're athletes with cerebral palsy that can throw with their hands. They cannot have assistance of any kind. BC3 athletes are those who have, quote, a very involved disability, according to the Canadian Paralympic Committee. These athletes use some type of assistive device to move the ball towards the jack. For those of you who might think it's far too easy to do that, I'm gonna again going to point out that these athletes have issues with coordination of movement. This might mean that spastic movements, i.e., uncontrolled movement, might be causing their hands, legs, torso, and other body parts to move constantly without the input from the person themselves. BC3 athletes might use something like a little poker-like object strapped to their head in order to push the ball, while various other parts of their bodies might be moving at random, far beyond their control. Still think that's not super impressive? These athletes can be assisted by another person who stays inside the player's box the entire time, but who must keep their eyes and their back to the play, meaning that they cannot help the player to better aim the ball towards the jack. BC4 is, quote, for players with other involved disabilities other than cerebral palsy. These players are not eligible for any type of assistance. There you go, my friends. Now, just like that, you're an expert in Paralympic bocce ball, kids. Just in case you're not fully impressed with these athletes, though, I have a little side story for you. When I was in high school, I had the privilege of meeting a Paralympic bocce player. As an overly cocky 16-year-old sledge hockey player, I offered to face this athlete in an abridged game of bocce in front of my entire school for an assembly. This guy, having only small stumps instead of arms and legs, and balancing the ball with his chin with one stump before he threw it, absolutely crushed me, a person who, in fact, has both of my hands. I'm also pretty sure he let me score some mercy points, too. These men and women are no joke. Elite athletes. Full stop. Ready to move to another sport? All right, let's become experts in another pretty unique Paralympic sport, shall we? Let's go check out goalball. Goalball is the second of the Paralympic sports that does not have an Olympic counterpart. Goalball is a sport that is exclusively played by athletes who are legally blind or visually impaired. Now, before we do this, I want to make something clear. First, I'm not a person who is blind. So the research that I'm presenting you is based on research I've done through what I believe to be reputable sources, and not through my own personal experience with blindness. Though I truly believe that there's still value in what I'm giving you here, I also acknowledge that there's no better teacher than experience, and I simply don't have it in this case. Similarly to how high school Mel, and even current Mel, definitely couldn't beat a Paralympian at bocce. If you're a blind person and you'd like to add to this, or maybe even join me for a future episode, just like always, you're totally welcome to send me an email at offside.podcast12@gmail.com. All right, partial disclaimer out of the way. Let's learn goalball together. Goalball was a sport that was invented in 1946 in order to help rehabilitate veterans who had lost their sight during World War II. As you'll see, it involves an incredible amount of awareness and proprioception, as well as an almost superhero-like degree of concentration. Three things I assure you I do not personally possess. Now, one more important thing to note is that, like I said, goalball at the Paralympic level is open to athletes who are blind or have vision impairment. But what do either of those two things mean, you ask? No worries, offsiders, I got you. Here's what those two terms mean, according to the fine folks at UK-based charity focused on disability. Blindness, to put it simply, refers to, quote, a state of not being able to see. This lack of vision comes from a genetic condition, injury, or a particular disease. The folks at the Arizona Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired would be proud to know that I'm going to put an asterisk on that for you. According to their statistics, about 85% of folks who are diagnosed as being legally blind actually have some remaining residual vision. That means that they may still be able to see things like color or shapes or shadows while still being considered legally blind. Only about 15% of blind folks see absolute and complete darkness. This is why when we start talking about goal ball itself, and or you start watching it yourself, you'll notice that athletes all wear blindfolds while in play. This ensures that no one who might have some residual vision has an advantage over someone who doesn't, or might have a different visual impairment altogether. So I bet you're asking, but Mel, that's what blindness is. What is visual impairment? Just like most pods, I love it when you ask me questions like this. I'm so glad you asked, Offsiders. Again, according to our friends at Focus on Disability in the UK, visual impairment is defined as, quote, an umbrella term that refers to all kinds of vision loss, regardless of if a person has remaining vision or not. Visual impairment basically states that a person may be considered to be visually impaired, meaning that they still have a larger degree of vision than their blind counters, but they still have enough to have it be considered an impairment, or their ability to see is still significantly impaired, usually due to some condition. Some examples, which I'm going to give here, are macular degeneration, cataracts, glaucoma, and Stargardt's disease. Just a final note here on visual impairments in everyday life. Some folks who are considered legally blind may also be referred to as visually impaired interchangeably with their blindness. That's just the political correctness thing that literally has nothing to do with the Paralympics. I'm not sure what a blind person's preference would be. You should probably ask them. But only after you've genuinely talked to that person for longer than 5 minutes. That said, for the case of the Paralympic classification, there is a distinct difference between blindness and visual impairment. That's important for splitting their athletes into the right classification category. We'll talk a little bit more about that, though. Want to learn the rules of this epic sport? Me too. Let's go learn goal ball, kids! According to the Canadian Paralympic Committee, here are the rules of goal ball. Each team consists of 6 players, with there being no more than 3 players per team on the court at any given time, 2 wingers, and a center. Like I stated above, regardless of their level of vision, all athletes don blacked-out eye masks, which have the express purpose of not allowing any light in, or have the athletes have the use of any remaining vision. This ensures that the athletes with the lowest vision are not disadvantaged by the athletes that may have some remaining vision. The game is played on an indoor court that has tactile sections and lines so that athletes can know where they are on the court and whether or not they're facing the right direction. Athletes throw a ball, known as a goal ball, hence the name, which weighs 1.25 kilograms or 2.75 pounds for our American friends, which, for context, is just a little bit bigger than a small medicine ball. This ball also contains bells within it so that the players on the court can hear where the ball on the court might be without being able to see it. Players at the Paralympic level have been known to throw the goal ball at around 60 kilometers per hour or 37.3 miles per hour for our American friends. I'll say it again. Have you ever tried throwing a medicine ball with your eyes closed, no less? Like I said before, elite athletes, folks. On either end of the court, beyond the tactile center line, which divides the two teams, are 2 goals. The nets themselves are 1.3 meters high, or 4.2 feet, and 9 meters wide, or 29.53 feet. So the goals are not very high, but they are very long. The object of the game is for teams to roll the ball from their end of the court to their opponent's side and make it past the players and into the goal of the opposing team. The team with the most goals at the end of 2 12-minute halves is deemed the winner. If the game is tied at the end of this 24-minute time period, they'll play 2 overtime periods, which are 3 minutes long, and operate under the golden goal rule, where the last goal wins. Our friends at CNN would also like to point out that if there's no goal scored after that, then they move on to a shootout. Now I have just three more rules to make sure that you have an understanding of this epic game to complete for you. Another important rule that applies to both spectators and players on the sport is that they must remain silent during the play, with breaks, of course, for goal celebrations. Though it may seem obvious to you at this point, this rule exists so that athletes on the court can hear the bells on the ball so that they know when it's heading in their direction. If you think it's an odd rule, then I'd like to raise you tennis, a game in which umpires in able-bodied tennis actually silence the crowd before each serve, a move I'm not really sure is necessary. In goalball, though, silence is totally necessary. Honestly, it's actually pretty cool to watch. I think it totally adds to the intensity of an already pretty intense game. Alright, two more rules, and then I'll give you a quick crash course in goalball classification. Again, according to the Canadian Paralympic Committee, there are two throwing rules that are pretty important. The first of which is, quote, "A thrown ball must touch the floor before passing over the center line," also called the high ball line, which is 6 meters from the goal line at the thrower's end. In other words, you can't just chuck the ball through the air over the line, because this would impair the other team's ability to hear the bell that marks it. The second throwing rule is related to time. A throw must cross the center line within 10 seconds of the defending team controlling the ball. Players can also pass the ball between themselves to move to more favorable positions, but the most important thing is that the ball crosses the center line within 10 seconds, or they'll face a time penalty of some kind. Alright, now that you're all caught up on the rules of goalball, let's talk about those ever-confusing classifications. Classifications for goalball. Despite the wide range of vision versus non-vision, which can constitute someone being blind or visually impaired for the Paralympics, the classification for goalball is actually fairly simple. Those who play goalball are allowed to fall under one of three categories, from B1 through B3. B1 refers to the most blind athletes who are totally blind in the way that you might have thought or imagined it being before educating yourself on this podcast. Pat on the back to you. B2 refers to athletes who have some sight, like seeing shadows. And B3 refers to those who might have slightly more vision than which was included in B2. They might also be able to see something like color. Again, all that to say, all athletes wear black eye shields so that all competing athletes are equally unable to see, regardless of their classification. All right, folks! That concludes my crash course to make you at least partial experts in two of the Paralympics' most unique sports. Like I said before, I'm by no means an expert in either of these games. My simple goal was to give you some info that might help you enjoy these games just a little bit more. If you want to know more about how more of these Paralympic sports work, you're in fact in luck, as I'm going to be making a second Paralympic episode in which I'll teach you about two more of my favorite Paralympic sports, so that you can impress your friends with what you know about the games for the second section of the games. Look, the lucky part for you is that I wrote both of these episodes back to back, so you'll get them, one right after the other, with no wait. Just a caveat, that I had initially intended to go over classification and rules for all Paralympic sports, but I discovered quickly that in order to cover the sports that I wanted to cover with enough nuance and care that they deserved, I only really had space to do two sports per episode. If there's another Paralympic sport that you'd like to see me cover, feel free to drop it in the comments and let me know. Given the games only last 14 days, though, there's a pretty good chance that those will come out after closing ceremonies. Either way, you'll be prepped and ready for LA 2028, and I'd be happy to oblige. Alright, folks, that's enough talking from me for now. So remember, it doesn't matter if you're onside or offside, just as long as you're inside the lines. Have a good one, guys. The Two Line Offside podcast is a SoundShifter production, meaning it's written, edited, researched, and produced by yours truly. Shout out to Dub Sound of Pixabay.com for the intro and outro of this pod, and also Queb Sounds of Pixabay.com for the music. Lastly, if you think I was onside, or maybe if you thought I went offside, you can email me at offside.podcast12@gmail.com. See you next time, guys.